Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a couple of subjects in the news. First, of course, is Libya and the shifting political sands in the Middle East as the Arab Spring claims another dictator. Veteran CIA Middle East operative Robert Baer joins us to analyze the fast and unfolding collapse of the 42-year Gaddafi regime and what kind of regime might replace it, and how this latest domino of falling dictatorships will influence events in Syria, Palestine, and Iran. Then we'll talk with the author of the groundbreaking book that unveils the secret history of our machinations and deals with oil dictatorships in the Persian Gulf, as only a few decades ago the United States suddenly moved from an oil exporter to a country increasingly dependent on Middle East oil. Andrew Scott Cooper, the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East, joins us. Joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story, came out this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good to be here.
And the ground is shifting so fast in the Middle East, and particularly under Gaddafi's feet, the way that the largely Western rebels took Tripoli so fast, I think, caught everybody by surprise. What do you think is the day after scenario here, given that it looks like the Western rebels and the Berbers in particular seem to be the ones that really did the real work, and the Eastern Benghazi people are the ones that we've made all the deals with?
Well, I think it's premature to declare any sort of victory that we would accept. The country's very much divided, has been through its history, and with Gaddafi gone now, I mean, whatever his fate is, whatever power he's left, he doesn't have it anymore. That's the point. And we have a vacuum. There's no other way to describe it. The rebels are not unified. They don't have a government. There hasn't been a cabinet since the first week of August. You had General Yusuf murdered, assassinated, and there's been no conclusion on that, who did it. It was probably his own tribe, I'm hearing. But the point is, there's nobody to take reins of power in Libya right now. And as these things go, there's a chance that the Libyans can start fighting each other. I'm not saying they will, but there is a chance. You've got all these weapon stores have been looted by the mob, and any time weapons like this float around a country or beyond the borders, it's going to look a little bit like Iraq in 2004 when Saddam was removed. And you have old grudges, tribal differences, and so on. And, I mean, we don't even begin to understand a country like Libya because it's been closed off for so long. And there are no experts on Libya. And I'm not even sure the Libyans really understood their own country. And Gaddafi was a tyrant, and he's on his way out. That's pretty clear. So what do we have? I expect the worst.
Well, on the optimistic side, of course, there is, this is a victory for the universal aspiration for freedom. And at this point, everybody seems to be sharing, at least in that victory.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I think it's a wonderful thing. He's gone. I mean, he has a lot of blood on his hands. And, his longevity was never assured, and it was going to go anyhow. And supporting the rebels, there wasn't much of an option for the West, for NATO. But the point is, you've always got to consider blowback in a situation like that. That's the way the Middle East goes. This was never going to be a situation where there was going to be an easy transition, like Eastern Europe, communism to democracy. They don't have the same traditions. And that's all I'm saying. And then there's going to be a temptation, certainly going to be pressure. We're seeing it from the right for the United States to step in and stabilize the place until it does get a government. And that would worry me if I were sitting in the White House.
Well, what does seem to be happening here, though, since the Arab Spring broke out, is that how often we've been caught by surprise, how quickly events change. And it would seem already that what happened in Libya is being echoed, at least in street demonstrations in Syria, where now they're saying, now that Gaddafi's gone, you're next, Bashar.
Well, I think this is monumental. I've written a book about Iran. It was some sort of regional superpower in the because it had influence over Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Lebanon, you have the Shia arc. Now, if this busts up because of Syria, all calculations are off, you know, are back on the table, and Iran is certainly going to be affected by this because its influence in the Arab world is going to be sliced away, especially in Lebanon, because Hezbollah can't get weapons. I mean, so anything can happen. This is all these events in the Middle East are completely unprecedented. You know, even in 67 or you know 58, all these momentous changes and the coups against the royalty are nothing like compared today. And there has never been so much optimism in the Middle East as today, or if Bashar goes down and these people will be liberated, it's just going to be a very, very uneasy transition, and it's not going to be clear-cut for many, many years.
So let's Bob Baird, try and walk through some of these changes, since you're both a specialist in the Arab Middle East as well as Iran. Already, for example, inside of the Palestinian divide with Hamas and Fatah, as you know, there was a recent incident on the Egyptian border where the Israelis retaliated, killed some Egyptian police, which infuriated the Egyptians. The calculus there is, of course, changing since the Arab Spring and since the fall of Mubarak. But apparently, the actual incident itself was precipitated by an Iranian-sponsored group inside of the Hamas territory. And now there are indications that Hamas itself is backing away from its sponsorship by Assad in Syria and Damascus and allying itself with its more natural allies, its founders, if you will, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, the street scares Tehran. I mean, Hamas is essentially the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. And not surprisingly, they have sided with the street in Damascus, which is against the regime. It's a minority regime. These are Shia Alawites who control Syria, about 12% of the population. They've always been at odds with Sunni fundamentalists. And for Hamas, then, to side with them was almost inevitable as these things go. Now, the Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, has always had tighter operational connections to the Iranians, to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Force, the Quds Force. And right now, the Iranians would like to change the message, because it will be a catastrophe for Iran if the Alawites fall in Syria. And if they could somehow get people thinking about the Arab-Israeli conflict rather than the street demonstrations in Syria, they could save something. I mean, I don't think they will, But the fact is, these fault lines in the Middle East keep on coming back to this reset position, which is sectarian.
But it seems like the Iranians are finding a losing battle. I mean, they pumped over $6 billion to prop up the Assads. They've sent in their IRGC and the Basij to help the Syrians, the brother Maher and his thugs, suppress their own people, because they obviously had some practice at suppressing the Green Movement inside of Iran. But it seems that you would think that the constellation is ultimately allied against them. And I'm curious to know why the Israelis and the Americans, who neither of whom like the Iranian regime one bit, why are they? Have they been so cautious about Assad going down? Because
Well, I think that both Americans and the Israelis, and I'm including myself, are sort of, and everybody is that I talked in the region, is dumbfounded by these changes, and they're happening so quickly. And it's like a raging flood. You just don't know where the waters are going to go next. Who's going to survive? I mean, are the Saudis going to survive? You just don't know. But I think the Israelis and the Americans are cautious because they don't know what's going to happen in Syria. They simply cannot know whether the Muslim Brotherhood would come to power. And if it did come to power, would it be a moderate Islamic government, let's say like Turkey, or is it going to be closer to bin Laden? And that's what scares people. I mean, Tel Aviv and Washington don't want to be answering the question, who lost Syria? Look, if the Assad family doesn't know what way this is going. There's no way Washington can. I've got some contacts with the Syrians, and they are confused as well what's happening next. So Washington, Tel Aviv are too, and that's why they're sitting back, because it's unthinkable for the experts in these two capitals to predict precisely what's going to happen in Syria afterwards. That's why they're cautious. You know, Libya, we don't really care. Of course we do care, but not like Syria, because Syria is so geographically important. It's on Israel's border. It controls Lebanon to a certain extent. It's an Iranian ally. And of course, you've got the whole situation in Iraq, which, you know, weapons and the rest of it could spill across the border into Syria into some sort of conflict. And I'd be cautious, too, if I were sitting in the White House.
So there's a possibility then that the losers of the Iraq war, the Sunni bordering on Syria, will support the Brotherhood, if not already. Maliki's taken the Iranian position, hasn't he?
He's trying to create a Shia dictatorship in Baghdad. You know, I mean, it's clear he was going to do this with Iranian support and trying not to alienate the Americans at the same time. It's a difficult road to walk down, but that's what he's doing. And the Sunni, on the other hand, only see the Americans leave and they're lost. They're only 20% of the Iraqi population. So they would look at a revolution in Syria as, a rematch in the whole game. And they would clearly identify with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and support them.
But the one thing, though, that even though all of these chips are falling, the one thing that seems to be clear, again, I go back to this, to the affirmation of the basic human desire for freedom. And I don't understand why that should be surprising to our strategists.
Well, I mean, come on. You know, we don't press for it in Saudi Arabia. You're not seeing any contact between the State Department and the Saudi opposition. It just you'll never see it. I mean, that it truly is unthinkable, a revolution in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, we are hypocritical on that. And
sure.
Saudi Arabia is one of the most impressive states in the Middle East, but we don't talk about it.
Right, but even the other day, the Saudi king castigated the Syrians for being so brutal. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Well, you should stand in Riyadh Central Square and watch the beheadings. You want to see brutality. I just don't buy that.
Sure.
It's pure hypocrisy.
Right.
We want democracy in some places. We want it in Tehran. We want it in Tripoli. But we're not going to touch that one in Riyadh.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, veteran, the CIA operations officer, the author of a number of bestsellers, and we're talking about the shifting sands in the Middle East, where everybody's being caught by surprise. Now, of course, with the fall of Gaddafi, more pressure on Assad, the different strains that are changing in terms of the Palestinian alliances and Hamas backing away from Damascus. Do you think the recent shelling of Latakia by the Syrian Navy, was that targeting Palestinian camps? Because there had been some restiveness in the Palestinian camps. At one point, the Assads used the Palestinians to cross the border and probe the Israelis, I guess as a way of reminding the Israelis that they can cause them a lot of trouble. And apparently that backfired.
Well, the Syrians wanted to spark something with Israel, hoping they would change the message. But the Palestinian camps have always been the centers of dissent in one way or another, either for secular or Islamic. And the fact that the Syrian opposition would fall back inside these camps doesn't surprise me. It happens all over the Middle East. It doesn't matter what country. Syria's a different situation from Libya. It truly is. And the Palestinians are Sunni. Again, we go back to the sectarian thing. They're Sunni, 99% of them, and they are going to side with the Sunni fundamentalists in Syria. But we simply don't know who these fundamentalists are. That goes back to the complexity of this problem. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we may be able to live with them. We live with the Turkish Muslim Brotherhood, which is the ruling party. So, I mean, why can't we do the same in Syria? I mean, so to go back to your optimism about this, maybe this is an optimistic scenario where we're not going to change these countries into being completely secular, but we shouldn't immediately think of Islam as the enemy.
Well, I was just curious, though, about that old, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and then you turn that on around vis-a-vis the fact that the very noxious regime in Tehran is desperately trying to hold on to prop up the Assads, and we're opposed to the Iranians, and I'm just trying to figure out why we're not making some kind of choice there. And which is is the uncertainty of the Muslim Brotherhood worse than the certainty of IRGC?
Well, Tehran is the far enemy. At the end of the day, the Israelis aren't really truly worried about Iran's strategic weapons. The smart ones aren't. What they're worried about is their neighbors going over the edge, and that would be Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, where you've got sectarian warfare, some radical wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptians incapable of controlling their border, as we saw in the Eilat attack on the road, because they depended upon these regimes, military dictatorships, to keep control of the border. Now, if those powers lose control of the border, the Israelis are going to pay. You're going to have rockets coming across, and they're going to be going back the other way, and people, rather than worrying about national interests, are going to be yelling Allahu Akbar, because they remember, the Palestinians and the whole idea of the Muslim Brotherhood is built around the rights of the Palestinians in Egypt and Syria. That's where it all started. I mean, that's how the Muslim Brotherhood, when it fought in the 40s against Zionists, really got their wind as an anti-colonial, anti-Israeli power. And I think the Israelis are worried about that this will come back to the Palestinians and especially affect Gaza.
Well, the fact that the Iranians provoked this incident through their surrogates inside of the Gaza would indicate that that the Iranians see this as a good strategy, and they must think that is a fault line that's there to be exploited.
Yeah, it's a I think it's more than that. It's a provocation. I think they're more worried than anything of where this is going. And especially, you have to consider, if it succeeds in Syria and it succeeds in other countries, why not Tehran? And that something was unthinkable 2 or 3 years ago about the street rising against the regime in Tehran will come back again, and it could succeed this time. So again, going back to this could be a good thing, but again, it's the question mark. Anybody who tries to predict the Middle East is going to be wrong more than 50% of the time.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us here, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Andrew Scott Cooper about his book, The Oil Kings.